Okay, well, welcome everyone. Thanks for being here so promptly. I'm Ronnie Bowie, I'm the President of the Institute and Faculty of Actuaries in the UK, and it would be a pleasure in any circumstances for me to be here and chairing a session. But it's a particular pleasure to be chairing this one because the subject is what we in the UK regard as the Holy Grail, which is to get more and more actuaries outside the traditional areas. And we look to Australia and the stories we hear about actuaries in Australia spreading out well beyond the traditional areas as an inspiration. So I'm particularly looking forward to the presentation and then the discussion afterwards. In the UK, we still have over 80% of our actuaries in one or pensions, life assurance or general insurance. Now, half of the rest are in investment. So although we only have 5 or 6% outside those traditional areas, that's still 500 or 600 people. But we are engaged in a big exercise just now to find out how we get actuaries out into those wider areas. So this is of particular interest to us, as will be the discussion afterwards. And we have two distinguished speakers. They told me to say that. Speakers, both products of Macquarie University, both products of Aon Hewitt. And presumably, if you just sit there long enough, the name will change again. Aon Hewitt, Watson Towers, PW, Deloitte. Saffron and Jenny are going to take us through the results of this survey, which has been going for 9 years, but this is the first time it's ever been presented here at one of your conventions. So, over to you.
Hi, you'll notice that both of us are heading up, and we thought it would be more interesting if we shared the speaking so you don't get used to one of our voices when we speak. So, beyond financial institutions, how well do actuaries understand company risk concerns? Now, it sounds quite a provocative question, and we don't have the answers here. What we do have is we have Aon's Australasian Risk Management Survey, which is currently in its 9th year, which offers valuable insight into how organisations measure, manage risk and what their top risk concerns are. So the real thing is if actuaries are positioning themselves as risk management experts, how well do we understand our potential clients and our future employers? Do we actually understand what their real risk concerns are and how they manage risk currently? This is the risk survey that Aon produced. It's so hot off the presses, I don't have a hard copy yet because it was only released to the media last Wednesday. So it is the results of the current survey. Aon developed this survey to bridge the gap between the narrow view of risk management that exists in organisations, i.e. just purchasing insurance, to what it actually means in a company sense. This presentation will cover the results of this survey released last week, and we'll also discuss whether other industries are different to financial institutions, which is where we primarily work. At the end of the presentation, we'll discuss our thoughts on what this means for actuaries, but I think this is where we really want to prompt a lot of discussion in the room, because I'm sure hopefully the results of the survey will prompt you to think, well, what do we need to do as a profession as well? We're only aiming to talk for about 30 minutes to allow for a lot of discussion out there, and we're not saying that we have the answers. This is really presenting results so that the rest of you can discuss it. But first of all, I want you to start thinking in a wider sense. So I want everyone in the room to imagine that you are a CEO or a CRO of a large multi-industry fund or just a large organisation that's not in the financial institution space. And I want you to consider and potentially write down what you think your top four risk concerns would be. And think big. Think big groupings. Whilst you're doing that, we will run a short video to spark your thought process. Now, this video is quite current because it was created late last year. However, we have to acknowledge the recent tragic events that have occurred around the world, which are not included in the video, which demonstrates how quickly and therefore risk concerns change.
So, did that video change any of your thoughts regarding your top four risks? We're now going to go through the first, or the top four risks from this year's 2010 Aon Risk Survey. The first one, you may not be surprised, is brand and image. This has been the top risk concern for companies for the last 4 years, and actually has been one of the top four risk concerns of companies since the inception of this survey. I think a lot of it has to do with the fact that brand and image are linked to so many other risks that they see that as a paramount risk. There are lots of drivers that drive this risk, including ethics, compliance, product quality, social responsibility, and community relations. Although this risk has been in the top risks for the whole of the survey history, I think there has been a change into what's driving it being in the top four risks, and particularly with regards to social media at the moment. And Michael Broad, General Manager, Treasury Risk and Insurance at Coca-Cola Amatil Limited, has said, "I see social media as a big issue. Someone could decide to use social media to make derogatory remarks about any number of elements associated with an organisation." So therefore, they're very concerned about Facebook and things like that. People make one comment and it's to everyone.
Now, the number two risk in the survey was liquidity. Now, this has actually been the biggest mover over the last 4 years, driven by the GFC. The shift has occurred due to financial institutions tightening lending capacity, slowing economic activity, and issues with creditor collection. Interestingly, this did not jump immediately, and it was actually a lagged effect, as we'll see when we get to the trends. The risk drivers around this risk are cash collections, cash management, credit control, and cash flow shortages. Now, this risk is a financial risk, and it's linked very closely to other risks. And interestingly, the financial and economic risks were the only risk scores to increase this year, while other risk scores all decreased. And the other financial risks that had increases were capital availability and structure and credit.
The third risk concern for this year is human capital. And this has also been consistently in the top four risk concerns for companies. And I think this is a very broad risk. It covers strategic risks through to physical risks as they relate to employees. There's many risk drivers that affect this risk, including injuries, workers' compensation, absenteeism, staff attraction and retention, diversity, key person, succession planning, kidnap and ransom, productivity and talent. There's been a lot of changes in our world, and particularly with regards to the GFC. And one of the things that that has caused is a potential shortage of skills, particularly the mining industry. And that has caused some concern. In addition, you're all aware that there have been changes in compliance aspects, particularly diversity on boards, and, of course, changes to OH&S legislation. Media plays a large part in how people think about their risks, and the recent sexual harassment cases that have been brought against David Jones has also led to people thinking about human capital and the risks they face.
And I wonder how you're going with your top four, but the fourth one is IT systems. Now, this has a very strong link with information management, which was the fifth ranked risk. Increasingly, business functions and operations rely on sophisticated IT systems. And this is not just where they used to. This is across every aspect of companies, including HR and governance, risk and compliance that all rely on quite sophisticated systems these days. So some of the risk drivers inherent here is netware, hardware, software, and increasingly web-based technology, disaster recovery, and of course the new term at the moment, cloud computing. I don't know if you saw this in the media, and it was just last week. Virgin Blue claimed that the 11-day outage of its reservation and check-in systems, which are run by Navitar, cost it as much as $20 million in pre-tax earnings. Now, they actually reached an undisclosed settlement last week, but you can be assured that both of those companies would have suffered severe losses just from that outage. Craig Scroggie, the Vice President and Managing Director of Pacific Cimatech, said, "With companies now becoming inundated with data and information, focus will shift to how you use that information and how you ensure its security."
So you've seen the top four risk concerns, but you may want to know who was involved in the survey. Well, actually, it covered approximately 450 companies. They participated in the survey, and we did have a range of respondents, as you can see from this slide. 45% risk insurance managers, 18% chief financial officer, etc. The range of different roles represented were prominently dominated by those who are responsible for risk and insurance in an organisation, which you would expect. In addition to analysing the results, Aon ran a series of workshops and one-on-one interviews which were held to gain a greater insight into the survey findings. There were a number of industries covered by the survey. I know it's a little hard to see for some of you, but it covers manufacturing, financial and insurance markets, public administration and safety, right down through to wholesale trade. There were approximately 87% of the companies represented from Australia and 13% from New Zealand. Private companies were approximately 38%, listed companies 32%. 10% of the respondents were from not-for-profit organisations, and government entities were actually represented by 17%. So it was a fairly good broad cross-range of the Australian and New Zealand industries. A broad range of revenue levels was also represented, so it wasn't just the big end or the small end of the market.
One of the positive things about having a survey that runs and for as long as 9 years is you actually start to see the real trends that happen over time, and I think this is where we can really pick up some interesting stories. The first trend is the one I mentioned earlier, and that's that across the board risk scores actually reduced. The respondents actually have to give each risk a score out of 7, and so generally those scores reduced except for those linked to economic and financial risks. This is the first time that corporate governance actually fell out of the top 5 in a long time. And we think this is because companies now see this as business as usual. And in particular, they've also invested heavily in compliance and governance systems, so some of that risk is being transferred across into your systems risk. Another aspect around governance is that a lot of the recent governance concerns are around people issues, i.e., as we mentioned before, the ASX diversity and the sexual harassment case. So some of the governance concerns are also being reflected in the human capital risk. This does pose a question because, as you can see, it's quite reactive. Corporate governance shot to the top when the Sarbanes-Oxley rules came out. You can see that the financial risk, like liquidity, started increasing after the GFC. So it does raise the question about what would the outlook for 2011 be, particularly in light of recent events. Well, our view, there's still likely to be concern around the financial and economic risks, especially since due to the unrest in the Middle East, the impact of Japan, and the fact that the US and the European economies are still struggling. But another question we might ask is, will the recent natural disasters focus greater attention on physical risks and business interruption? And that might be something that you'd like to express your views on later. Another question is, are financial institutions any different to normal to the rest of the industries? I shouldn't say normal. As you can see, financial institutions actually have a very similar risk concerns to the rest of the industries. Brand and image is still their number one, and I'm sure you all can imagine the bank, when you think of the banks, their brand and image is very important. The insurers, when it came to the issues around the flood definition, the recent debate. Liquidity is number two, but in this case, liquidity is coming from a slightly different perspective than, say, the other industries. Claudia Batana, the chief operating officer of the VMIA, stated, "As far as the insurance industry is concerned, there have been a few significant natural disasters over the last 12 months, which may explain why liquidity has been rated higher. reflecting the need to free up assets to pay for losses flowing from those natural disasters. Now, that quote was taken in November last year. So just imagine what the recent events has had on the insurance industry with regards to liquidity. Now, the one risk up there that's different is the impact of regulation. I'm sure no one in this room is surprised to see that it's on the top four risk concerns for our industry. We're very well aware of all the ongoing government reviews and the increasing scrutiny from regulators. And I'm sure you're not surprised to know that we shared that top risk concern with the mining industry, who, of course, had the impact of the super tax discussions last year.
The next question we looked at was, well, who is involved in the risk management process? As you can see there are a lot of different people involved in the process. Some are in the business of formulating strategy, some developing and implementing policies, and others are monitoring and the policy implementation. There is a clear trend for the strategy to be developed at or set at the board, CEO or committee level, with the actual implementation being delegated to risk managers and divisional heads. But we feel that there's still some room for improvement for board involvement with formulating strategies for risk management. As you can see, it's still under 50%. We also have discovered that the number of CROs in companies has remained relatively stable in recent years, mainly due to the fact that large companies have CROs and many smaller companies don't, except for in the financial and industry and insurance industry, as you can imagine. And this is particularly obvious with the revenue of under $1 billion. There's much fewer CROs for those companies. Something we might like to discuss at discussion time, and actually I heard one of the plenary speakers this morning, or was it, they said, what's the role of the CRO versus the actuary? Well, we were going to ask you the question, what's the difference between the CRO and the CFO and how they might interact in the risk management process? As you can imagine, sometimes they might cross over and have different views. With regards to risk management outsourcing, there's also been a shift. And we think with the evolution of risk management, it's changed so that outsourcing is actually declining. And this is, again, because many companies are seeing risk management as something they need to do on a day-to-day basis and not just compliance checklists. And therefore, they're bringing more people in-house to do the role of risk managers, claims handling on a regular basis. Alexia Houston, National Insurance and Risk Manager at Clayton Utz Lawyers, said, "We didn't have a risk team 5 years ago. Everything would have been outsourced. Now we've brought most of it internal, with the use of external people as required for various pieces of expertise." You'll be very thrilled to know that actuarial is still a major item that is outsourced, 82%. And that might mean there's some future for actuaries and possibly being inside companies doing that risk management process rather than just being coming from an outsource. Negotiation and placement of insurance is also very highly ranked as something that is outsourced. If you look down, it's quite a jump then to the next one, which is legal services at 54%, and then right down to human resources. Many companies have brought those in-house over the years to 14%.
Okay, now moving on to the one formula in our presentation, and I have to warn you all, it is very complicated, particularly in actuarial convention. The total cost of insurable risk. This is the sum of the risk transfer costs, and I just want to highlight that even though it says insurance premiums on the slide, even though that is the majority of your risk transfer costs, it does also include other risk transfer vehicles and the cost of those, such as captives and catastrophe bonds. Your retained loss costs, external risk management costs, and your internal risk management costs. Now, we use this as a measure to see how risk management costs are changing over time. It's also supposed to deliver a measure of what a real enterprise risk cost is, rather than just looking at just insurance costs or your risk transfer. An organisation should work to target the lowest and, most importantly, sustainable TCOIR. This means that the company needs to understand their risk exposures and make informed decisions about which risks to transfer and which risks to retain. And our question we pose out there is, do companies actually really understand their retained risks? I think the recent issue over the flood definitions and what they believe they've actually transferred through their insurance policies versus what they've actually retained does pose an interesting question that we could discuss later. If you look at the actual scores and the ratings of the TCOAR by revenue band, I think it's inherently obvious that the big companies, as a percentage of revenue, would have a lower score. Interestingly, if you look at the base scores, these costs have actually remained stable over the last few years. The only reason why these scores have fluctuated is as a proportion of revenue. And as we saw revenue decrease in 2009, these scores went up. And as revenue improved in 2010, the TCOAR scores moved down. However, if you look down into revenue bands, there are declining real costs for smaller companies within these results. But the larger companies have seen incremental increases. The risk transfer costs, as we discussed, which is insurance, mainly insurance premiums, accounts for 70% of this cost. And as there's been a long period in the soft insurance market, we expect as the market hardens, we expect the benefits of alternate risk financing options to insurance to become more evident in these results. And this could also mean over future years we see this measure start to increase as the insurance market hardens. And I think you'd all agree that this seems quite straightforward, that organisations that invest in risk management tend to have a lower TCOIR than those that don't. A specialist risk management team improves the knowledge and understanding of the organisation's risk profile. Moving on to how these risk dollar spend is actually done based on all the respondents and then the financial insurance industry. Historically, larger organisations retain more risk, and that trend continued in 2010. But medium-sized organisations have started to increase their risk retention proportion. Now, this was actually an interesting result when we saw this because we weren't expecting to see that the financial institutions have actually transferred a greater proportion of risk rather than retaining the risk. But we think this is a reflection of some of the more sophisticated risk transfer methodologies that the financial institutions have, and that more than just insurance. And it also could come back to the definition of what is risk in completing this survey, considering that a lot of, for the insurers, risk is their business. The other interesting difference that I saw on this was the lack of internal costs that were reflected from the financial institutions. And I think that's what we just talked about. If risk is your business, then all your costs are related to risk, or none of your costs are actually related to risk. And we believe that's why these results came out this way. The financial and insurance services, I actually did look at who contributed, and there were a lot of some of our big banks were in there, big insurers, a lot of smaller credit unions and insurance companies, as well as some of the big superannuation funds are all in these results.
So what does this mean for actuaries? That's really where we're getting at, and that's what we want to discuss after our presentation. As other speakers have said today, it's really important for actuaries to realise that we can be part of a team and we don't necessarily know it all. So we believe that multidisciplinary teams are extremely important, and actuaries can be a part of that, especially when you come to things like the mining industry. You need to understand things from a different viewpoint for various aspects of the risk. You might need to use mechanical engineers, chemical engineers, miners, geologists. It's not something actuaries will necessarily have all of those things under their belt. Our second thought was business experience. Risk experience. It's important that the risks are considered because they're interlinked. So it's not worth just looking at one risk on its own. They need to be considered as a whole. and particularly understanding the business strategy and operations. If you don't understand the business, where they're wanting to head, you can't really give them advice about their risk management and their risk management processes. Communication and qualitative assessment. As you can understand, not all of these things are easy to quantify. Brand and image, even human capital, many things are hard to put a dollar figure on. So it's important to communicate with the various parties within a company and qualitatively assess the risks, as well as aim to find some quantitative way of assessing the risk. We believe there could be opportunities for actuaries, particularly in high retention industries. Many firms around the country have no idea how much risk they're retaining. Many would think they've actually transferred more than they actually have. And actuaries may be in a position to help them value, understand what they're retaining and value the retention and understand their risk better. And potentially we have an opportunity to educate as well as help value. We wonder if there's also an opportunity for innovation for actuaries. In many of the financial institutions, they are using more sophisticated risk transferring techniques than many other companies in various other industries. Are there opportunities for companies to use things like the catastrophe bonds? Are there vehicles that actuaries could develop that might help risk transfer for other industries? So as we expect the insurance market to possibly harden in coming years, we wonder if that also will increase actuaries' opportunities to use our risk financing skills, and particularly in industries outside of the financial services industry. And we wonder if there's things we can discuss here today that will help make this happen. Before we get on to discussion, I'd just like to remind you of our survey, which is now available. If you'd like a copy, you need to complete one of these forms. We've got some sitting at the front table here and some over at the bench just before you leave. Also, you can go to the Aon website and download a form to complete, and we will send you a copy of the survey. This was really just a summary of the findings. There's obviously more detail in that survey, and we'd be very happy to provide it to you. So we'd like to hand it over to you now for discussion and hope we can come up with some ways actuaries can be more involved in the future. Thank you.
Okay, lots of opportunities. Lots of opportunities for questions and discussion. So we'd like to go first. Yes, gentlemen there.
Wayne Brazel, AMP. Look, it's interesting what you've talked about today, but one of the things that we're certainly pushing in the ERM space is the fact that risk is not about just downside, but it's about optimising risk-taking and taking opportunities. A lot of what was here, from what I could tell, was very much around the downside. Have you had any sort of... So I guess there's a couple of aspects of the question. Have you had any feedback on the optimization? But also, when I look at your total cost of insured risk, I'm wondering whether you should have a component there for opportunity cost. So diverting resources to fixing a problem versus diverting resources to be able to, you know, drive your business forward.
That's a really good question, and it is the next stage in looking at risk. I think one of the problems, challenges we had when we first started the survey is a lot of companies only saw their risk costs in terms of insurance transfer. So the initial stage was even to have them think in terms of the fact that they're actually retaining risk in their organisation and that there are costs associated with managing risk. And that's definitely... That's the next stage, is it's a how can you quantify the upside of risk. I think it's going to be quite difficult and challenging, but I think at this stage it was more around educating and other companies being aware that there's more than just their insurance premiums.
Stuart. Stuart Fotheringham. I might just add to that in saying that one of the challenges and one of the opportunities, I think, for us all is that the organisations themselves, whether we work in them or for them, are still trying to get to grips with this. And we have a situation where there are many different stakeholders within the organisation manage different elements of this risk. So there's an educative piece, I think, for us all as we work with organisations to have them look at and understand the risks in a more holistic fashion. There's no doubt, however, that you can demonstrate, and we have the capability as a profession, demonstrate real upside value when these things are managed correctly. So whether it's reducing your liability and spend on workers' compensation, whether it's increasing your engagement or setting up a captive insurance organisation to carry some of your risks, there are real tangible benefits that you can demonstrate. And again, I think that's another opportunity and one where actuaries are well placed to assist, because one of the things that we do is we have a lot of data, we understand the data, we can analyse the data, and we can demonstrate in very tangible ways, I believe, the real benefits that we're bringing to the organisation to prove whether it's the strength of its balance sheet, its profit, its turnover in its staff, or whatever that measure happens to be. So there is a fair amount of work done around the upside of risk, and I think it's a very valid point. But there are some challenges along the way, establishing those real measures for some risks where the data is very thin. But importantly, I think helping the organisations to understand how to look at the risks in a way which gets them playing as a team, and then understanding what the upside potential is if they do that well.
Dave Morris, mainly speaking from wearing my non-executive director's hat, but one thing that always fascinates me about these surveys, and I've probably seen a fair few in my time in one guise or another, is that perception of risk seems to depend on recent events and also where you sit in an organisation. And you didn't actually present any figures, but I wonder, there's only about 7% of the respondents, I think, were categorised as being CEOs or directors, and I don't know whether you pulled out the figures separately, but one of the things that always interests me when these exercises are done is there is normally quite a big gulf between what the risk professionals, if I can put it that way, reckon the risks are and what the board or the CEO might perceive them to be. And I think also recent events tend to cloud things with about a 3 to 6 month time lag, because certainly from an insurance perspective, pandemic risk was the thing that everyone seemed to be terribly concerned about 2 or 3 years ago, when everyone was walking around with sort of smog masks on to avoid catching influenza of various degrees. The other point I wanted to make is that looking at those top four risks, that's all companies, which was the brand and image, liquidity, human capital, IT systems, they would all be, I would regard those as being generically operational type risks. And that's one area where I really would question what expertise actuaries actually bring. Maybe liquidity, managing cash flows and capital, but brand and image, normally the actuaries pick up the damage rather than anything else, but anyway.
Thanks. Just to your first point, I do actually have, the survey actually does have a breakdown by respondents to see if there is a difference between the different levels, and you're right, the directors and chief executive officers, they are slightly different for their top risk concerns. Their top risk concern is market environment. But number two is liquidity, and information management and corporate governance then follow. So there are the survey does break down those risk concerns by the respondents, and it also breaks them down by the industry. So to your point, an interesting what I found interesting looking at the various industries was that lack of innovation was the top risk for the information, media and telecommunications area, which when you think about it, that actually makes sense, but it was one of the only industries that had lack of innovation up the top. In terms of your other point about how actuaries can get involved, well, I wonder if actuaries can get involved in educating better and might change what the top four risk concerns are potentially, if they are, three of them particularly are very operational. I think in the human capital space, actuaries do have quite a lot of involvement currently and can have more, particularly we've at Aon got involvement with looking at absenteeism and obviously workers' compensation. They're quite large areas, but there could be more in even presenteeism and the cost, trying to quantify what it actually costs you to have unproductive workers, even if they're physically at work, and what it costs you to have absenteeism. People who are absent from work as well cost you quite a lot. I wonder even if staff retention and turnover is another place where actuaries can get involved in quantifying the costs of retaining staff members versus trying to replace them, which is quite a costly thing for companies. And again, often they haven't put a value on it. They know it costs them, but they haven't actually got some dollars to prove to them that maybe increasing the salary by an extra 0.5% is worth it when you consider what it costs to replace that particular staff member. So I do think there are quite a lot of opportunities for actuaries. Partially already, we're already involved, but I think there could be more. And I think education. There was a debate, and you can read a little bit in the survey, and there has been some in the media about brand and image, as to whether it is a risk or it's a result of risks. So there's a debate there as to whether brand image really is a risk in itself, or whether it's, you know, your brand image being, your reputation being destroyed because other risks have occurred.
I shared that same reaction when I saw those risk things. It seemed to me to be that, oh gosh, those are things we hadn't thought about, or oh gosh, those are things we're not terribly well prepared for, rather than the result of a mature kind of thought process of what really were the risks for business. It did seem to be a fashion cycle. And living up to the title of the conference, Go Beyond the Mandate, I've been and got this microphone from over there, thereby releasing this group here who probably thought they were safe from needing to ask a question. So that I'm going to go even further beyond the mandate and walk down and give you the microphone if you're prepared to ask a question down there. Who's next? Don't let me down.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Yeah, look, I certainly think actuaries have a role to play here. And when we look at the sort of range of risks that have come up in your survey, I think on the one hand, you look at that list and you think, well, none of those seem quite neatly aligned to what actuaries do. But I would contend that actually no one really owns this space. You highlighted that actuaries have a role to play in multidisciplinary teams, and I agree strongly with that. No one owns this space. And I think we've got a role to play in terms of helping boards and management teams think through risks, helping them understand how scenarios play out, whether you're well prepared as a business to be able to deal with those scenarios. I think the challenge for us as a profession, though, is do we have the communication skills we need to be able to step up into this environment?
Just a comment, and I'm not sure how to solve the puzzle, but I'm always bothered by the concept of total cost of risk. At least you've called it total cost of insurable risk. But when you try to add those things, you're really adding apples and oranges unless you insure the whole thing. You know, if I had first dollar coverage and then I decided to retain $2 million of loss and my expected losses are $5 million, yes, probably the sum of that and my excess insurance was less than the first dollar coverage that I had, but now you're adding an apple to an orange because you're not quantifying the risk, you're quantifying the expected value of the losses, and that's a very different concept. So has Aon done anything to try to advance the concept from the traditional risk managers, oh, I'll just add up all these pieces and surely I've got a savings there and I can present it to the CEO why we should retain the risk, without really even contemplating the additional risk that you've taken on?
Yeah,
might be going outside of our area of expertise, but do we have any of our Aon Benfield people here in the room? I'm sure if you go and talk to Benfield at our stand, this is something that they're very active in that space. So I won't claim to have expertise in that area, but I do know that Aon does look at that around the world, and particularly in the Aon Benfield reinsurance space.
To come back to that question there, I mean, in the UK, as we've been wrestling with this question, well, there's obviously a huge need and a huge opportunity. What is it that ACTRIS can do? And in particular, we've been thinking, what is it the Institute and faculty can do? And I know the Institute in Australia has been thinking the same. I think there are kind of two obstacles. Well, there's a double-edged sword, is that the great strength when we do surveys of non-traditional employers and organisations, and the big thing that they say is positive about getting actuaries involved is the kind of way we think and our preparedness to try to quantify stuff, because otherwise they can never get a grip on it, and therefore some ability to quantify uncertainty is a help. But the downside is the other side of that coin, whereas we're always so desperate to quantify and get an answer. So the thing we're completely unresolved in this in the UK is that our greatest strength inevitably is also our greatest weakness, and somehow we need to use that reputation for being able to quantify things without it becoming a straitjacket and becoming imprisoned by it. And the other thing we wrestle with is how much of it is down to enterprising individual actuaries to blaze a trail, and what is it the professional body can do to kind of market and get a following wind and put some positive wallpaper up for our members, so that they're better received when they go along to non-traditional employers with that message. On behalf of the Institute in Australia and on the Institute and faculty in the UK, I'm very interested to hear what any of you might think the professional bodies might do to help create that following wind, to allow the enterprising actuaries to go in and make some more hay in that area.
It's an interesting question. I think part of the problem as to why it's a double-edged sword is that we're so busy wanting an answer rather than be happy with the uncertainty and advise on how you would manage that uncertainty. So rather than just saying, well, I think this is the answer, I think, we should be in the practice of saying, well, this is our feel for the risk. This is what we would recommend as a way to dealing with it, and these are the measures we need to put in place to make sure it's tracking the way that we're expecting, and the actions we would take if it starts to go off track.
So is that concept that Seamus Creedon had up in the plenary, the edge of plausibility, to kind of get people? Because one of the things, if you have very remote risks, like there's going to be a thing in Japan and it's going to cause 6 nuclear reactors to fall, and they say, well, of course that won't happen. But if you can get something that's actually on the edge of people's plausibility, you get people engaged, and then you can maybe actually work out from there. Does anybody use that concept of the edge of plausibility to draw their clients or their employers into the discussion, so that everybody's got a starting point from which to do all those things, kind of get some sense of the size of the risk, and then more importantly, the mitigations and the risk transfer that might take place? Is that edge of plausibility, is that a useful concept?
Micheline Dion. This is like in Canada now, for insurance company, we are forced to do some of those tests, like to go to the edge of what we, so that our board could visualize what type of risk that they could be under, and they can make a judgment as opposed to us telling us it won't happen or it will happen. They can get a sense from their own point, their own perspective, whether that's feasible or not. And it does bring much more useful discussions than just a statement by the actuary.
I'd say that you've also heard several times today about the Chartered Enterprise Risk, actually Chartered Enterprise Risk Analyst, CERA qualification. But at the moment, the emphasis there is to get the credentialing done, to get some people through, to build up the numbers of CERAs who are out there. And there are another 210 going through the British examination system in next week, I think, of whom half are from Australia, because, as you know, the Australians have adopted the UK approach for this particular examination. As we build up the number of CERAs, the intention is to turn from the website mostly being about information about how you get started on that to what Stuart Following was saying earlier, which is to get some success stories up there, examples of how actuaries and CERAs in particular have worked with clients to actually turn risk management into a value-added proposition rather than a cost reduction proposition or whatever the other thing is. So I hope that those of you who are involved in that and who begin to get some success stories and feel able to put them into the public domain, and we'll put them through the Institute of Australia so that we can add them to that website and gradually build up those case studies and those success stories that can also be shown to prospective clients and employers as examples of positive value added from actuaries. We've got time for one more question. Who would like to do the last one, please? The back half of the room has let the side down badly today, just because you're sitting in the back doesn't exempt you. Once the back half of the room has asked a question, you're free to go. I still remember what it was like being at school. Well, the back half of the question has let me down. Well, I'd like to do a couple of things. Firstly, I'd like to nominate that gentleman with the tie there to collect your feedback forms as you leave, so thank you for volunteering. And I'd also like to thank Jenny and Saffron for their contribution to this afternoon, to present them a small gift on your behalf. Thank you.